Welcome to the Ludogogy Podcast, your monthly games-based learning earworm. I'm Antonis.
And I'm Sarah. And today we welcome Jay Dragon. Jay Dragon is the creative director and head publisher at Possum Creek Games. Jay is a queer disabled game designer born and raised in the Hudson Valley, whose interest in role-playing games began with running large-scale live-action events for up to 100 participants at the Wayfinder Experience. Jay's first published game was Sleepaway in 2019, a horror RPG about a group of queer summer camp counsellors keeping their kids safe in a strange and uncertain world. In 2020, Jay launched Wander Home, a pastoral fantasy RPG about travelling animal folk and the world they encounter. These days, when not writing games or managing Possum Creek, Jay can often be found sitting on a dock by the creek, listening to music and watching the sunset. Jay's games have a focus on building communities, engaging in ritual, and immersing oneself in a shared fiction, and have so far been awarded Gold Ennies for Best Family Game and Best Cover Art, both for Wander Home in 2022. Welcome, Jay, and thank you for coming to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me here. I'm excited to be here.
So I've already introduced you, but one of the things we like to do with all our guests is to get them to tell us a little fun fact about themselves that might not be common knowledge. So what are you going to tell us about that, Jay?
So there's a lot of fun facts. I think the one that tends to often take people by surprise is just the very simple that Dragon is a family name. It's not a pen name or a pseudonym or like a thing I chose, but rather a family name. It's kind of odd having a fun fact that's just, you know, that it's not that I didn't make a choice, but it was just a very apt name that I happened to start with, and kind of, you know, I guess when you get a name like that, what else do you do besides become a game designer?
Exactly. It looks like it was meant to be.
Yes.
There is that. There's so many links back to games with that as well, isn't there? It's sort of like all that idea that people become something because of the name they've got. And you can link that back to the game Happy Families, where you've got Mr. Bun the Baker and Mr. Bones the Butcher and so on.
Well, I think names are really fascinating because they names shape you. And you shape the name, right? Like, my mom and I have talked a lot about how Dragon is like kind of a burden of a name. Like, it's a very, it kind of sets people up to assume a lot about you. But it's also, I think, a name that I have a lot of kind of capacity to shape, right? Like, you know, it gives me, like this kind of palette to work from. And when choosing my first name, because I'm trans, and you know, that's part of the shtick you gotta do. there was the very interesting thing of how do you choose a name that sort of self-articulates but also kind of reflects with my heritage that I'm already working with. So names are fascinating little objects that we have them.
Has your name been an inspiration behind your game creation process?
I try to avoid that as much as possible. I think it gets a little sticky when it's like, Jay Dragon wrote the Dragon game, right? And like, there was a time when I was a teenager where I was very kind of anti-dragons just because it felt redundant. But at this point, to me, they're like a cool mythical creature. And there's like an interesting kind of counter identity with them. Like, I have a poster in my room of the dragon triumphing over St. George, and it's a screen print of the classic St. George and the Dragon, but the dragon is devouring St. George. and so in that sense, they kind of it's kind of almost like a you know, like, yeah, it's the big bad monster, right? You know, that kind of like, you know, if everyone thinks it's a monster, right, might as well have some fun with it kind of energy to the name.
Yeah, it kind of sets the scene.
Exactly, yeah.
If it's not the name, then what is it that what's your source of inspiration for your games? Do you have like any kind of process that you're following?
Yeah, I tend to talk about myself as an experience-based designer, where a lot of what inspires me for game mechanics is a sensation or like a moment I have where I go, that was an interesting moment. How can I create the mechanisms needed to replicate that emotion, that moment, right? So the moment when that clicked for me when I was a kid was I was 16, I was in chemistry class, and we were turning copper sulfate into like this, like, particular, we were making some kind of like acid. We were doing this like cool chemistry experience. And I was sitting there and I was doing it. And I was like, this makes me feel like an alchemist. This is a physical reaction. This is a physical kind of process that changes the way I feel about myself emotionally, right? Like by doing this physical action, I'm allowing myself to perceive myself as something different. And that kind of got me, you know, thinking about, well, if I can control a physical process, right? Because if it's a game, I can give you a physical process to do. And that changes your character perception, right? The way you are playing yourself, then that could be, that's a game, right? And that has kind of been a lot of my, you know, I'll have a moment in my life where I go, that was really interesting. How can I isolate that and bring, how can I pull that out and isolate it in a lab and bring it to people?
And that's definitely something I've noticed about your games. The first time I played Wander Home, it was a total revelation to me. Obviously, I played Dungeons and Dragons for, well, decades.
Same here.
But playing Wander Home was a completely different experience to me because it is so much more about the feels. You know, I love goblin bashing as much as anyone, but it's very different when you come across a game that really invites you to think about your emotions and to play with emotion in the way that Wander Home and similar games do.
And the artwork is amazing. I love it.
The artwork is phenomenal. We really wanted to make... I'm very interested in like the holistic experience, right? The idea that a game text, every single part of it should be teaching you and immersing you in the game, right? That it's not like the words need to be doing one thing, the art needs to be doing a different thing. It's that the art is just as important as the words when it comes to articulating and imagining this world. So to that end, a lot of like kind of what I try to do with something like Wander Home is it's like, I have a feeling, hope in a hopeless place. How can I build every single structure of the game? You know, how can every single part of the game in its own way be utilized to create this experience, this sensation that was the catalyst? And that kind of, that's how you end up with it, right? And then, you know, at a certain point, it was like, oh, well, this should be animal folk for this reason. You kind of, you know, the setting builds on top of that set of experiences and comes back and reinforces what you're doing, and you've got the whole process.
Wow, that's so inspiring.
You were mentioning game mechanics. What is your favorite game mechanic, and how have you used it in your games, if you have such a thing?
I'm super picky. I like a lot of different game mechanics in a lot of different ways. I think right now a lot of my interest is in what I kind of call, I think I call them aspirational mechanics is the term I've used. Although I oftentimes think of them a little like memento moris, but the idea of a game mechanic which doesn't need to show up in play to heavily influence play. So the kind of classic example I go to is in Dungeons and Dragons with leveling up. That level 20 in Dungeons and Dragons does not exist to be played. Like, you're not, like, 99% of D&D does not reach level 20. That's not the point of level 20. The point is to make you want to reach level 20, right? It's an aspirational mechanic. Through its existence, it changes how you play, right? If XP didn't go anywhere, you wouldn't have any interest in that kind of what's at the top. Similarly, you see this in Heart with Christopher Taylor and Grant Howitt, where every single class has a capstone that is this incredibly powerful ability that also kills you. And its purpose isn't necessarily to like be used all the time or to kind of like, oh, we'll get there every one shot. The purpose of it is to like set this kind of aspiration that like the greatest thing that can happen to your character is that they die. And in Wander Home, you see it with the playbook, The Veteran. The Veteran has a seventh move, has a seventh ability, which no other playbook has. Because The Veteran is the only one who, in a peaceful world, understands the nature of violence and understands kind of the horror of it. And so The Veteran has the capacity to kill someone once. They are removed from the game, but they have this button they can press that kills someone. And I find that interesting because the purpose of the mechanic is not to kill people. The purpose of the mechanic is to remind the player of The Veteran that they uniquely possess this ability to destroy another person's life. And only they are the ones who understand what that means, right? Because when you've been hurt, when you've hurt people, when you've seen kind of the horrors of the world, and you come back to this more gentle, caring place, it's hard not to let go of that tool that you still remember.
So just to sort of, so that I can be clear that I've understood what you mean by an aspirational mechanic, would the fact that all the creatures, all the playbooks, in fact, in Wander Home are on a quest to find their home, which might not necessarily be the place they came from, but it's somewhere where they're going to belong. Is that an aspirational mechanic? Because certainly in all the times that I've played it, I've never found my home, but it's something that drives my character clearly, because that is the intention of the character.
Yeah, I reckon so. I think that to me, an aspirational mechanic is like more than just a goal, but like a system, like a rule. And so like the part of Wander Home where you have those advancements to choose from, and the ninth one always involves leaving that character behind, which means that there's kind of this inevitability of always eventually no longer being able to play a character. That is, I think, aspirational in that way, where it's like this kind of concern with a mechanic that won't show up in most games. But even without the mechanic being used in a game, its presence influences how we play.
To me, that sounds like, I'm getting a bit meta here, but to me, that sounds like there's a lot of reflection from an individual's real life struggle that can be or should be reflected into a game design process. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we live in a world of systems, right? Like we live in a mechanized, in some ways gamified world. And frequently, the systems that shape us most heavily are not the ones which we have kind of this direct interface with, rather are ones that exist kind of over our heads, looming over heads, right? Like in a capitalist sense, right? You know, we exist predominantly in a society of proletariat and bourgeoisie, right? Where the predominant system of extracting profit from labor is a mechanic that, kind of shapes all of us, although the majority of us only engage with kind of a little piece of it. But I think just in general, the idea that like a game mechanic sculpts more than what it immediately engages with, right? Like you don't have to have something coming up every single session for it to shape how we play, right? A game mechanic can show up once in 100 times and can show up never, but still change how we think of what it is to play the game, right? A really simple example of this kind of, and the reason why I call it a memento mori is because if we sit down to play a game and before we start, I pull out a knife and I slam it into the middle of the table, we are playing a different game than we were before, right? That has changed the game. Even if the knife, we don't touch the knife, the knife's not used, we don't engage with the knife, but the presence of the knife changes the game. Right. And to me, that's what like an interesting game mechanic can do as well.
Wow. That's incredible. Like I never thought of it that way before, but yeah, that makes a huge difference. It's the environment and the aesthetics of the game and the things that are part of the game that you're not interacting with in a very tangible way. They also affect how you play or how you design in that sense.
When a lot of game designers talk about what games are, they tend to assume this kind of like core mechanic supremacy of like a game is composed of the mechanics which you're engaging with all the time, right? If you play Dungeons and Dragons and never roll any dice, you didn't play Dungeons and Dragons, right? Because you didn't engage with the mechanics, right? This idea that the mechanics are the game is the sum of the mechanics which are used. And that's not true, right? Because mechanics change how we play even when they're not used, right? The designer's purpose is not this kind of like rigorous sculptor of experience, but rather kind of this provider of tools. And I think that is a really kind of like, that's an important part of how I design and also a really important part of understanding games as something that goes beyond kind of the strict mechanical understanding into kind of a cultural ritual phenomenon.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And it becomes really obvious that when you're looking at games like Wander Home, as opposed to games like Dungeons and Dragons, which on the surface seem to do the same job. They are games about shared narrative. But with Dungeons and Dragons, it's very mechanical. You've got all of those sort of tables that you're rolling the dice constantly to find out how combat resolves and so on. And because of the presence of a dungeon master, you've got that situation where a story has already been written and you are going through the motions of fleshing out that story. But with games like Wonder Home, again, talking about things that may never happen, you've done some world building, and there are bits of that world that will never get explored. But that world is all there. It's all there to be explored, and all that potential is there.
Yeah, and I think that it's a lot like the OSR in that respect, or sorry, the old school Renaissance as a, you know, and many other designs like that that are interested in that kind of procedural and emergent approach to world and to character. Yeah. The idea that all of this might exist, but the GM isn't necessarily like accessing this like story knowledge, right? You know, the GM is accessing this kind of world that exists, but the story of what happens is something we even apply afterwards.
As a designer, how does one approach this complexity, and especially when it comes to things that are there but you're not interacting with, all the elements or components of a game that are not tampered with, but there simply are in the whole environment? How do you approach this as a designer?
For me, it's a very holistic process, right? That it's this understanding that every single part of the game is as important as every other part, right? That I try not to phone any component of it in, that like the rules and the prose and the art and the layout. And that's why I kind of surround myself with really talented people. And I think that if you are a designer and maybe you've released some games and you want to take it to the next level, you need to surround yourself with talented people. You know, and like, I work with editors. I try to prioritize editors who don't specialize in games, right? So Kazumi is my go-to editor. You'll see their work on Wander Home and on the upcoming Yasuo's Bed and Breakfast. And Kazumi is an editor of poetry, first and foremost, right? That they are they teach poetry and they teach Asian American and Native American studies. And that is, and like they play games, but their skill set isn't about games. You know, or like my business partner, Ruby, is a, you know, has, you know, a degree in graphic design and illustration. She's done a ton of work in art and art direction. And when we work together, she's the one bringing in all these heavy hitter artists and bringing in the visual language. And, you know, I studied art history. I have a bit of a background in art, but having someone who really knows that stuff back to front means that I can trust her to really kind of create a visual language that goes beyond the thing I've made. So I think that, you know, how do you make something holistically? You know, to a certain degree, you know, be a jack of all trades. To a much more useful degree, it's about connecting with talented people who know a lot more than you about specific areas and bringing their focus in.
Wow. So going through all that, I want to circle back to a question we usually continue with, and I think there's a natural segue to that now. What is the biggest challenge you have faced in your own game design process? And if you overcame it, how did you do that so we can learn from you?
I would say endurance and consistency, that some of the hardest parts of game design is just making the thing. I think that the perfectionist impulse is wildly destructive to creative desires. And so a lot of like developing skills for myself has been about killing my inner perfectionist and letting myself, you know, just play the game as it is, show it to people, get their feedback as soon as possible, and just build on that. I think that is kind of my, I must emphasize, right, that I've even though I haven't been making tabletop games that long, I've been making games since I was pretty young. The first LARP I ever ran was when I was 14, which has given me a certain degree of a leg up, right? That it is just true that to be a game designer, you make a lot of games, and most of those games will be bad. And I think that sometimes people assume that I only write bangers. because they've only read games that I've released in the past 3 years, right? Because that's when I first started putting them online. But I've been making games for more than a decade. And let me tell you, most of them are really bad, right? In just the, you know, kind of if you lay it all out chronologically. And so I think that making bad games is the hard, making bad anything is the hardest part about being a creator, right? Like to be an artist, you have to make a lot of bad art. To be a writer, you have to write a lot of bad books. So I think that letting yourself make bad games is probably the single most valuable skill that a person could apply to their games.
I hear you.
That's really good advice.
It's hard to finish something. It's hard to finish things that you know are bad.
And I've got so many articles in Ludagogy that people have written about learning from failure and what a useful skill it is and how that can be applied in games-based learning, obviously, because you can, you know, you can create games that get you to fail and then you try again and try again. And it's really refreshing to hear somebody applying that to the idea of actually making games at all, which is, yeah, really interesting.
there's a wonderful quote by a chess master whose name I don't remember, but it's, I have lost more games than you've ever played, in regards to how they became a chess master, right? And so, you know, the idea is that the chess master is not the person who wins 90 games. The chess master is the person who loses 100,000 games, right? And so the writer is not the person who writes one good book. The writer is the person who writes 50 bad books. And as a game designer, you know, that's why I think a lot of people like to start with 200-word RPGs and one-pagers, both because it lets you fail fast and it lets you practice finishing things, which is the other kind of hardest part about being a creator. And giving yourself avenues and pathways to complete projects quickly and get them out there and move on to the next project builds up the stamina both for failure and for completion, which are, in my experience, really tough for a creator to kind of implement.
Apart from your own games, which I imagine you enjoy playing, I certainly enjoy playing them, whose other games or which other games do you really enjoy playing and why?
So the Baker family, the creators behind Apocalypse World, Firebrands, and Under Hollow Hills are enormous for me. The Baker family, you know, Meg and Vincent basically laid out the groundwork for design that people are still kind of figuring out in Navian, right? There's still secrets to Apocalypse World. It is a game that has aged like a fine wine. I love Avery Alder. She's my mentor in a lot of ways. She's my inspiration. I would not be in game design without Avery Alder's work, things like Monster Hearts and Ribbon Drive and Dream Askew. And The Quiet Year, of course. Ray Najati is my best friend in games, and I love his work. Apocalypse Keys, Balak Bayan. He has a really smart eye for mechanics. Jian Shen is also a dear friend of mine, and her works are much more kind of poetic and cerebral and like engaging to, you know, they're very much like solo ritual experiences. And I have so many games I love, right? 10 Candles by Stephen Dewey is a masterpiece. That was kind of the breakthrough point for me. I'm so picky with games to actually play, but also at the same time, there are so many games that I absolutely find myself coming back to over and over again. Because I think that, like, you know, the indie scene especially, there's just so much incredible stuff that is kind of bubbling up and coming forward that I find myself, you know, just wanting to come back to.
Yeah, I agree. I think the level of inventiveness seen in indie games is just astounding. How much of that do you think that's due to the fact that it's such a sharing kind of community, that really the ethos is behind, here's something that I made, by all means make something that's based on it, as long as you know acknowledge where you got your inspiration from. But that idea that it's not just encouraging people to play and become players, but it's also encouraging people to become games designers and creators in their own right.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the indie scene is a very kind of creative, inspiring space. And it's very focused on a DIY, like, make them quick, make them dirty, make whatever you feel like making kind of atmosphere. I also think that we're seeing right now this kind of somewhat unprecedented opening of the doors when it comes to game design, that there are, like, in 2019, there was a doubling or tripling of the number of indie games being released. There was this enormous explosion. You know, it's been called the itch.io explosion, this huge outpouring of creative work. And the energy and momentum of that is still ongoing. And I think that this kind of, like, you know, the sudden collapse of the gates, right? The doorway between the creator and, like, the doorway between the creative and the act of creation has never been less guarded. And so I think that suddenly we're seeing all these people who never had the opportunity to make games before getting to really dig in and make stuff over and over. And that is the best thing for any creative scene, right? It's that, you know, like, people who didn't have the chance before suddenly can make a bunch and try it out and make new things and try out new ideas and expose others to their ideas.
Good timing too, because it was right before the pandemic. Eh?
Yeah. And I think what a lot of people are doing, which I find really, really intriguing, is they're really playing with and bending the idea of what a game can be. Sort of things that you wouldn't normally have seen beforehand are being considered to be games. I mean, you know, at the extremes, you've got things like the one-word RPG and things like that, which are great. And then there was something that I found on Exalted Funeral last week, which was, what was it called? An adventure game in need of translation. And I just love that. It's a completely asemic game. So you've just got this pamphlet with strange illustrations and an asemic language, and you just decide what the game is. You just make the game up. It's brilliant. It's just such a good premise.
Yeah. As one of the as one of the founders, or kind of like the first wave of people doing lyric game design, which is lyric games are the movement that I kind of started with, which started in 2019 and is a creative movement dedicated to, like, a lot of different people trying out alternate ways to think about games. And to me, it's a very sensible thing, right? That when suddenly the doorway to creation is kind of wide open, you're getting a bunch of people who want to explore narratives outside of what is traditionally there. And to do that, they want to utilize tools which have not traditionally been present, right? Tools of translation, tools of imagination, tools of ritual, tools of, you know, a relationship and storytelling and magic, things that don't actually show up in games that frequently, that kind of, you know, now it is very easy to make a zine and try out this idea that you've never kind of seen implemented before, how to merge the poetic in the game, these sorts of things. And I think, like, a lot of what inspires me in the indie scene are games that, you know, like, I will oftentimes make these experiments of games that are unplayable or not interested in being played, or, you know, reject play or complicate play. And then I experiment with those, and then I take those lessons back to my larger projects. You know, like, the whole thing of aspirational mechanics comes from this interest in, you know, like, the unplayable game, right? Because the 20th level Dungeons and Dragons is this kind of unplayable game. But that's not its point. You know, it's doing something else. And so a lot of what excites me about game design is that everyone is experimenting with these models of play that they've never touched before. And I think certainly a lot of these experiments will be failures. They won't be interesting, or maybe they won't find market appeal, which is never really the point of these sorts of experiments. But some number of them will go on to shape future games. That's the cool, interesting part that I'm excited for.
Yeah, sounds like when the process of creating games is a game itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, like, on this the purpose of a game in a lot of senses is to teach you how to make the game, right? A game unveils its design to you.
What kind of games are you playing at the moment?
Right now, so I'm currently, as we're recording this, in Colombia, and I'm about to go off for a month, so my game playing is somewhat limited, but I will be playing a lot of games while up in the mountains. I've brought a whole bunch of my favorites. I was doing a playtest of Far Roofs by Jenna Moran, which was a really delightful experience for a bit. I was playing Apocalypse Keys somewhat recently. I'm a little in between things, but I'm hoping to start up a Lancer campaign next year, which is not my normal cup of tea, but it has the tools I need for the idea I have, which is all you could ever ask for from a game. So I like to play a bit of everything. Oftentimes, what I have time for becomes the hardest question.
Yeah, I'm similar in that manner.
Mm-hmm. It's like, there are more good games than there is time to play them.
Okay, so with that in mind, obviously we've been talking a little bit about the games, game mechanics you like, and the other games that you like apart from your own and your the designers that and the games you're playing at the moment. So, which games designer do you most admire, and maybe a suggestion of somebody you'd like to see on this podcast?
Oh, you should talk to Ray Najati. Absolutely, he's a great designer. He's got great thoughts. He's so smart when it comes to mechanics and their relationships and how a mechanic can just totally kind of, these leading questions that can just beautifully tease out and pull out this whole narrative. His work is so smart and interesting. I think you should absolutely talk to him.
I can absolutely agree with you there because I've been playing Our Haunt, and in actual fact, I've had the great experience. I live just down the road from an intentional community, which is based in a 19th century Strawberry Hill Gothic house.
Oh my God!
As a setting, it's really untrue. But not only that, but the people who live there have come from all over the place, and because it's an experiment in communal living, what a lot of them are doing are actually exploring how they came to be there. And what they're there for and where they're going. So it's so appropriate for that game. My cat now. Oh, God. He's actually downstairs. That gives you some idea of how loud he is.
Oh, come on. We can let the cat interrupt the podcast. There's worse things in the world than a couple of meows in the background.
If I let him in, we'll all be drowned out. Okay. Should I go through that again, or is there anything you can salvage from that, Antonis?
I think it's fine. I think there could be a cat in the background, you persnickety sound designer.
Yes, I'll try to not let my perfectionism ruin the podcast. We can play with the cat.
I think you should keep a little bit of this dialogue as well, because I think it's funny.
That house sounds like we should run a LARP there. With a cat too, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, that's one of the things that I'm looking to do, definitely. There's another game I've got lined up for them, which is it's a hack of Monopoly written by a guy called... It's called Utopoly. So basically it starts out with a Futures Workshop where you basically hack Monopoly and come up with different forms of currency instead of money and try and build a utopian society. It's quite cool. It's not my game, I hasten to add, but myself and the designer are hoping to run some sessions of it there.
When I was younger, I squatted in this old mansion, and truly, there is not a better place in the world to run games. Like, it is so, like... Just there's like just always feels so like over the top that you get to play. It's like, oh yes, let's retreat to the drawing room. It's like, oh my God, please.
Circling back to a different question now. We talked about experienced designers and your experience in design and other designers we should be interviewing and learning more about. Now let's get to the beginning of it all. Imagine there is a completely new person starting out in game design, what kind of advice would you give to them?
I think I would have a couple critical pieces of advice. The big one is find peers. Find people at around the same spot you are, maybe a little further ahead, maybe a little further behind. Find people who you connect with and share ideas with them, bounce ideas off of them, and play games with them. Horizontal networking is the kind of the snazzy marketing definition. Making friends is the practical, what it really is. You want friends you can play with and you can think about games with. Once you have that, once you have a sense of writing, once you kind of get in the habit of making things, you talk, the stuff we talked about with failure earlier, once you're kind of doing that, you know, everything else is logistics, right? Any other advice I could give is going to be so situational, right? Like, if I tell you, you know, put your games up on itch.io, that might not necessarily be applicable in 4 or 5 years from now. The important part, the timeless advice, the thing which you always want to be doing is finding peers to play with and letting yourself fail. Everything else is logistics. If you've got those two things, you can find your ground.
That's the perfect advice.
Absolutely. One of the things that I often find with sort of people that I have things to do with, particularly in the games-based learning community, because quite often people see themselves as learning designers first and games designers second, and they kind of put off the games design as a fun thing because it sort of happens after work, is we don't give ourselves enough time to play, which is something I've tried to tackle with sort of live sessions with Ludagogy, yes. But it's still quite a resistance, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty much my personal motivation. You know, I come from the learning design world, and then I got into, well, I was always into games, but then I got into game design as a result of trying to improve my learning design, and now I'm even more into game design than I'm into learning design. But yeah, I totally see the challenge.
You have to be careful, because when you're first starting out, your enthusiasm and desire to create will feel limitless and like passive, right? Like, you don't have to maintain it in any way. You can just trust that you like games and that will carry you through. But the reality is that the more you do this sort of stuff, less, like, the more time you put into making it work, which I would not necessarily recommend people turn game design into work. I think when the healthiest relationship you can have with it is to not have it be a full-time job like what I have. But as you put more work into it, you will exhaust those reserves and you will burn yourself out and you will be like, why am I so burnt out and sick of games? And it's because you're not playing them, dingus. You forgot to play games. You got too into games. And, you know, I try as much as possible to create kind of an active time for playing, right? Like, carving out time in my life to play games, because I hit the bottom of my well. I was sick of games. I had like a 6-month period where I contemplated quitting. And at the other side of that, I was like, I just need to remind myself why I like games. And I did a pretty good job of reminding myself. And that has been very helpful for me, is, you know, you hit the limit and it's like, where did my enthusiasm go? And it's like, well, you stopped doing the part that's fun. Of course you got sick of it.
Yeah, I've seen that in pretty much every creative kind of job. I've seen it with musicians, I've seen it with painters, I've seen it with video makers. I've seen this repeated again and again, and it's a very good advice for everyone outside of games as well.
Well, at least what's convenient about games is that the output is so different from the input, right? Like, to play a game, to design a game are very different, like, levels of sociability. Whereas, like, watching a movie and making a movie, it's, those are pretty different as well. But, you know, writing a book and reading a book, I guess, are pretty overlapping. So it's a lot easier. Or, like, you know, like, making paintings and looking at paintings, right? But, you know, with games, it's like, hey, just remember that, you know, where you get ideas from is ultimately from the games you play, right? Like, games are an active feedback loop. Games are built on experiences, and part of those experiences are the ones that you go out and have, and part of those are the ones you play at the table.
This month's theme in Ludagogy is the other, and we're looking at the way games interact with the idea of people different from ourselves, the idea of difference, diversity, and all those other things that could be construed from that theme. I'm aware that your games are talked about in the sense of allowing people access to those ideas because you use mechanisms like belonging, outside belonging, and so on and so forth. So what is it about your games? My feeling is that from a games-based learning perspective, I feel that if I can introduce people to your games, that some in some small way makes the world a slightly better place because it gives people more understanding. What's your kind of take on the games that you make and how they might make that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think I hope so, right? I hope that I can make things that can engage with people. I think that the big thing to me lies in the name of the system that I commonly use, which is belonging, outside belonging, right? So when we talk about centering, right, which comes up a lot in kind of leftist environments, but also, you know, kind of anyone who's interested in this kind of critical work, there's the idea of who is centered, who is decentered, right? Who is at the center of the conversation, who is at the margins? And in most games, there exists a very kind of, there is the interest in what is at the center, and then there is the discarding what's at the outskirts, right? Games always center something, right? That is part of what a game is, right? The games, you know, the game is this act of centering. And for me, what interests me is in belonging outside belonging, right? To find the margin, to find the edge, and to center that instead, right? What are the communities that exist at the edge of our society? What are the stories that are told outside of where stories are normally told, right? What belongs when we are outside of what normally belongs? And in doing so, you create new marginality, right? You create these new edges where what you cannot anticipate is present. And I think what's really critical as a creative or as anyone who's kind of interested in this sort of work is you have a responsibility to make space for that which you cannot anticipate, right? That the margin will always include things which you don't know about. And that, I think, is what is hard and what I think maybe stands out about my games is that I am not designing for the people I am aware of. I mean, I am. They're my heart. But I am making space for the margins that I am not yet aware of, right? The sets of experiences which I am not even cognizant of that I know that someday I might discover or that maybe I won't even. But it's important for me that my game does not simply center on the outgroup, but rather creates a space for many outgroups, many of which I couldn't envision. My friend and editor Kazumi frequently quotes Subcommander Marcos of the Zapistas, who said, we must imagine a world with space for many worlds. And to me, that is the very critical thing about game design, and doing so in a way that actually makes space for the outside, is to understand that not only are you trying to push aside the mainstream, not only are you trying to make space for people on the margins, but you are laying the groundwork for more space for the margins which you cannot even yet see, right? To understand that always at the edge of the map, there be dragons, right? And that even beyond, once you fill out that map, there's more space, right? And so the challenge is not to just make a separate space, but to make an environment that is space for many worlds.
So obviously, when we're talking about sort of games-based learning and learning from games and learning in games and learning about games, what would be a lesson that you've learned from designing games that can be applied to the rest of life?
No, your cat has a very intense meow. Yeah,
immaculate sense of comedy timing.
Oh, absolutely. What lesson have I learned from designing games? I think the big one is you can't design for bad people. A really common kind of maximum indie games is don't design assuming bad intent. Like, don't assume that the players are going to misuse your game and defensively protect against that. Design assuming that the players are compassionate, good people, and give them the tools they need to build that up. Right? Like, you know, a really classic example of that is with safety tools, where it's like, don't implement safety tools assuming the players are monsters. Implement them assuming that they're good people who need assistance, with who want the safety net because it'll make them feel good. And I think that that's also just like a good philosophy in life, right? Don't do things assuming that the people around you have bad intent. Do things trusting that people mean their best, and give them the tools they need to do their best. And if someone disappoints you, kick them out of the fucking kick them out of the room, right? I don't know if I'm allowed to curse now, but kick them out of the room. the thing is that, you know, if someone is being a jerk at the tabletop, that's the same thing as them being a jerk in real life, right? Like, if someone's being, you know, like, a thing I've talked about with my friends a lot is, like, if someone's being racist or homophobic while you're playing a tabletop game, there's no game mechanic that fixes that. That's like the same problem if someone's being racist at the bowling alley, right? It's like, stop it. Right? Like, that's not the game. That's not a thing the game can solve. That's a thing you have to solve as people, or to get rid of, you know, as people. And similarly, as a player, as a person in real life, if someone's being a jerk, there's no amount of like design or forethought or preparation I can put into that. I just have to be willing to tell them to go away.
Wow. When you were mentioning designing something, assuming the best of people instead of that they were going to be the worst, I immediately thought of how social welfare systems are structured in pretty much most of the planet. Yeah. They're designed kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, like, that's also because the purpose of that kind of design is to keep people away, right? Like, when you assume everyone is a jerk, you limit their access to things. When you assume bad intent, you limit their ability to access things. Whereas when you assume people are good and are looking out for their, you know, their best interests and interests of the people they care about, you know, it's a very different relationship to what you're making, right? It's a non-adversarial relationship. But we as game designers and we as people exist in a carceral world where we have a carceral mindset and a punitive mindset, and we only understand things through our ability to enforce the laws that we, you know, we treat games as laws, and laws can be broken, and when they are broken, there is a punishment, when that is not what a game is. And that kind of relationship to play, I think, leads us to this bad faith mindset.
Excellent. Thank you.
What's coming out soon from Possum Creek then? What should we be looking out for?
I guess I'll really quickly mention that I didn't talk about it much on this podcast, but Possum Creek Games has an upcoming game called Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. It is a legacy-inspired tabletop, slice-of-life tabletop role-playing game about an interdimensional B&B. I can say with confidence that you've never played a game like it before. it is going to be a truly phenomenal game. We crowdfunded it last year, did very well, and it should be coming out sometime in 2023, so keep an eye out for that. And you can pre-order it now on BackerKit, and you should go and do that.
Thank you so much for being with us, Jay.
Yes, it's been wonderful and really, really enlightening things have been discussed here. And I'm sure Ludagogi listeners will be absolutely delighted and inspired.
Thank you for having me. It was a delight.
Yep, full on inspiration. So this has been the Ludagogi podcast.
Game over.